Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The statistics about the opioid crisis continue to get worse. 142 Americans die of a drug overdose every day. That's according to the CDC. Two-thirds of those deaths are linked to opioids. Since 1999, the number of deaths involving opioids have quadrupled. Americans now consume four-fifths of the global supply of the drugs. A December investigation by the Charleston, West Virginia Gazette Mail found that from 2007 to 2012, pharmaceutical companies shipped more than 780 million doses of hydrocodone and oxycodone to West Virginia. That's about 433 pain pills for every man, woman, and child in the state. In March, West Virginia ran out of money for burial assistance for families who lost loved ones to an overdose. The problem is just so horrendous that yesterday a White House commission formed to tackle this crisis issued a report urging the Trump administration to declare a national emergency. The authors wrote, quote, "With approximately 142 Americans dying every day, America is enduring a death toll equal to September 11th every 3 weeks," end quote. Well, a number of states and cities, including Ohio, Missouri, and Chicago, are suing pharmaceutical companies, saying that they caused this crisis with a campaign of fraud and deception. Missouri Attorney General Josh Hawley said the suit against companies like Purdue Pharma, which makes OxyContin, will seek hundreds of millions of dollars that will go toward drug rehabilitation and efforts to help families affected by drug addiction. And then here in California, Santa Clara and Orange counties are suing five companies, including Purdue and Johnson & Johnson. In January, the city of Everett, Washington filed a lawsuit against Purdue, saying the company knew the drug was being sold on the black market and failed to intervene. This lawsuit comes after an LA Times investigation. Senator Claire McCaskill in Washington, D.C. is demanding corporate documents from five companies. She wants to know how they market their drugs. So on today's Your Call, we're going to talk about the drug companies and their role in all of this. Should they be held responsible for this crisis? Today, we're joined by three guests. Sam Quiñones is an independent journalist and author of three books. His most recent is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Hi, Sam. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back. Thank you. We're also joined by Liz Esley-White, a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit investigative journalism organization. Last year, Liz teamed up with the AP on a 10-month investigation about drug makers' influence on the response to this crisis. Hi, Liz. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Andrew Kolodny is co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management in Waltham, Massachusetts. Dr. Kolodny focuses on the opioid and heroin crisis, devastating families and communities. He's also executive director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. Hi, Dr. Kolodny. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We should also say that we invited the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, the main lobby for Big Pharma. They said they cannot comment on legal actions regarding specific companies. We also invited Purdue, the maker of OxyContin, but they said they could not make the time work. Dr. Kolodny, you're with us for the first 10 minutes, so I want to start off with you. The statistics are just shocking. 142 Americans die of a drug overdose every year. There's been incredible reporting at the local level about how this is just affecting communities across the country. Give us a sense of exactly what we're facing today.
So this is the worst drug addiction epidemic in United States history. And when I say that, I'm referring to the number of Americans who are addicted. And I'm also referring to the death toll. Since 1999, more than 300,000 Americans have lost their lives to opioid overdoses. Most of those deaths were due to prescription opioids, but in the past few years, we're seeing deaths among heroin users begin to skyrocket because of fentanyl in the heroin supply. So what we're dealing with is a severe epidemic of opioid addiction that's leading to record high levels of deaths. It's leading to a flood of heroin and fentanyl into non-urban areas. It's leading to a soaring increase in infants born opioid dependent, children winding up in the foster care system, outbreaks of injection-related infectious diseases. I could keep going. So we're paying this enormous economic and human price for this epidemic. What's important to understand is that this is a man-made epidemic. Mm. The reason we've seen this sharp increase in the number of Americans who are opioid addicted, a 900% increase since 1997, is because the medical community has been over-prescribing. And as the prescriptions went up, addiction and death went up right along with the increase in the prescribing. What's very important to understand is that the medical community didn't just start over-prescribing out of malicious intent. This was a response to a brilliant marketing campaign that was launched initially by Purdue Pharma, ultimately by other opioid manufacturers. So starting in the 1990s, doctors begin hearing that we had been under-treating pain, that we were allowing patients to suffer needlessly because of an overblown fear of getting patients addicted. We start hearing that the real risk of addiction is much less than 1%, and that the compassionate way to treat just about any complaint of pain is with an opioid. And we didn't just hear this directly from the drug companies. I think we would have been more skeptical. We were hearing it from pain specialists eminent in the field of pain medicine. We were hearing it from our hospitals, from our professional societies, even state medical boards. From every different direction, we were hearing that if you were an enlightened, caring doctor, you'd be different from those stingy, puritanical doctors of the past that were under-prescribing. You'll understand opioids are a gift from Mother Nature that should be used much more for people with pain. And as we responded to this brilliant campaign and as the prescribing went up, it led to this public health crisis that we're dealing with today.
Can you talk about these companies downplaying the addictive properties of drugs when they market to doctors? A Los Angeles Times investigation into Purdue Pharma, which makes OxyContin, they marketed the drug as relieving pain for 12 hours, even though they knew that the drug wore off before that time period. And since the drug didn't last as long as promised, so many patients suffered withdrawals, which led them to become addicted to OxyContin.
So Purdue Pharma misbranded OxyContin, promoted the drug as less addictive because of its extended-release formulation, and they got into trouble for that. In 2007, they were fined over $600 million, and three of their top executives were found guilty of criminal charges for the way in which they minimized the risk of addiction with OxyContin. But that was really not the worst of what Purdue had done. The worst of what Purdue did was to change the way the medical community thought about opioids as a class of drug. They got us to think about opioids as being safe and effective for conditions where they're not safe or effective. And so really the worst of it was the non-branded aspects of their campaign that changed the culture of prescribing in the United States. And because they got into trouble for some of the specific things that they said about OxyContin in 2007, but didn't get into trouble for really the worst of what they had done, they were able to keep doing many of the things that they had done. And the new litigation against the opioid manufacturers is focused more on this campaign that changed the way we were prescribing opioids in the United States.
Well, that was my next question. When Purdue paid $600 million in fines back in 2007, what actually changed? Did the government require Purdue to change the way they market OxyContin?
Very little changed. So as a consequence of that settlement, Purdue was not able to continue making some of the same specific claims it had been making about OxyContin, but they were allowed to continue to promote OxyContin and opioids as a class of drug as being safe and effective for daily long-term use. And so they continued to do that, and opioid prescribing continued to increase after that 2007 settlement. So unfortunately, they really did miss the worst of what Purdue had done.
To date, Purdue has made $31 billion from OxyContin, which hit the market in 1996. Dr. Kolodny, I know we have to let you go. Two questions before we let you go. What do you think the government should have done at this time when Purdue was made to pay a $600 million fine for misleading doctors and patients?
Well, FDA is our federal agency responsible for regulating pharmaceutical companies, and if FDA had been doing their job properly, going back to the release of OxyContin in 1996, what FDA would have done was to have told Purdue, great, you've got extended release oxycodone, sounds like a good drug for patients at the end of life with cancer pain, we're going to let you market for that condition, we'll let you send your drug reps to visit the hospices and the oncologists and the palliative care docs, but your drug is not safe and effective for people with common chronic conditions. We will not let you promote for low back pain. We will not let you send your drug reps to family doctors and to dentists. If FDA had done that and enforcing the law properly, they would have done that. I don't think we'd have an epidemic today. And certainly by the early 2000s, it was clear the prescribing was taking off at a rate much greater than could be clinically needed. And at that point, there were things FDA could do and, again, missed an opportunity. So, you know, we are now beginning to hear from the new commissioner of FDA that he's planning on making some changes. FDA did just hear last week from the National Academy of Sciences that they need to overhaul their opioid policy. So we may finally see some better regulation of opioid manufacturers, but there have been many missed opportunities, which is why the epidemic has grown so severe.
What do you think about the lawsuits that we're now seeing at the county, city, and state levels?
They're very important for three reasons. They're very important because states and municipalities across the country have a very expensive problem to deal with. Babies stuck in the hospital longer than they should have been are expensive. Mm-hmm. Children in the foster care system, treating hepatitis C can cost $100,000 for one patient. So they have a very expensive problem to deal with, and it makes perfect sense for them to look at the corporations that created this mess for the money to help clean it up. But the litigation is also important because the pharmaceutical companies, the opioid manufacturers, are continuing to promote aggressive prescribing of opioids for conditions where they're not safe or effective, and through this litigation, we may see an end to that. And then the third reason, which I'm hopeful Liz White will talk to you more about, is the opioid manufacturers didn't just play a role in promoting aggressive prescribing that led to this epidemic. They've also been very active for many years now in blocking state and federal interventions that could produce more cautious prescribing. They've outspent the gun lobby in efforts to block more cautious prescribing. So, you know, I think this litigation may also put an end to some of those activities.
Well, Dr. Kolodny, thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Andrew Kolodny is co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management and executive director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. He's one of the lead doctors that is speaking out on this crisis. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any personal stories to share about opioids and painkillers, the Trump administration put together a group that would give recommendations on this. And one of the recommendations, in addition to saying that it's a national emergency, the commission says that doctors need to figure out an alternative to deal with the 100 million Americans who deal with chronic pain. So if you have chronic pain, what has your relationship been like with your doctor? What kind of drugs did you get? Do you feel like the right questions were asked? If you have any relatives or anyone who's been affected by this, we'd love to hear from you. And then what do you think about the government's response? And should drug companies be held responsible for this crisis? Joining us for the rest of the hour is Sam Quinones, an independent journalist and author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and Liz Esley White is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Last year, she teamed up with the AP on a 10-month investigation about drug makers' influence on the response to the opioid crisis. Sam, you have been following this for many, many years. One thing that Dr. Kolodny said is he feels like only now is it finally getting a lot of mainstream attention. We're hearing from politicians.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yes, that's true. I wouldn't disagree with anything Andrew just told you there. I think this has only recently gotten a lot of attention. One reason I would say that this has only recently gotten a lot of attention, even though it's been festering for a good 20 years, I would say, as a problem, is that it mostly involves white people and largely middle-class white people now. And the reason I say that is because a lot of those folks who were getting addicted and having their family, loved ones getting addicted in their family and so on, people dying, were from, this was largely a white phenomenon. And they did, the vast majority of those folks did not want to make this public. And so they hid it. And there was it was very similar to what was going on during the AIDS epidemic, the early days of the AIDS epidemic. People wanted to hide it because it was so shameful, so mortifying, so embarrassing. They thought also, I think, incorrectly, but nevertheless reasonably, that they were all alone in this, that there was no one for miles around who had a child die in a McDonald's bathroom toilet with a needle in his arm, that kind of thing. And so what I found when I was doing my book was really startling. I think it surprised me that I could not find parents who wanted to talk about this. It was very difficult. I'm a kind of a veteran of the crack years when I was first a crime reporter in Stockton. And there was no difficulty in finding parents and community members and residents who wanted to talk about the plague of violence and all the stuff that went along with crack. It was very easy to do. People aggressively wanted you to do that. With this, it was very, very different. People did not want this known. People lied or fabricated reasons for the cause of death in obituaries. My feeling is the reason that there is far more attention to this in the last 2 years, one reason is that you are now see people coming out of the shadows in much larger numbers. You're seeing people mention in the obituaries for their loved ones, their brother, their wife, their son or daughter, what have you, their grandchild, why that child really died. And you see this more and more. You see on Facebook, you see parents playing a more public role. And I have to say that I think that that is very healthy for them. It's certainly healthy for the country. Mm. This thing spread because people did not want it known. And when you don't have parents involved in the conversation, the parents or the loved ones, the siblings, the grandparents, the spouses who can tell these very, very poignant stories, you're missing a lot of the energy from below that would give rise to a lot of awareness and attention. That is what's happening now for the last 2 years. I would say it was not happening before that, I don't think.
Liz, what would you say? Can you talk about how this story has unfolded?
Yeah, I think, we're now at a point where a lot of people, even if they don't have anyone in their immediate family who's been touched by the opioid crisis, they know someone from high school or they have a cousin. It's touching so many different people's lives, and it's kind of peaking in terms of public awareness. I would say there are some people, just to kind of piggyback on Sam's point, a lot of people out there saying that now that people are aware, the level of compassion that's being shown towards this crisis is, not the same level of compassion that was shown towards the crack epidemic. But because its victims are white, there's a lot more people willing to look at it as a sickness of addiction instead of a moral failing.
Right.
So that's one thing to keep in mind as you think about the course of the epidemic.
Right. No, that's such a good point. And Dr. Kolodny mentioned the piece that you wrote with the AP, Liz. You spent 10 months on this piece looking at the lobby for this very powerful drug industry. And you found that the makers of painkillers have adopted a 50-state strategy that includes hundreds of lobbyists and millions in campaign contributions to help kill or weaken measures aimed at stemming the tide of prescription opioids. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so we looked at what drug makers had done at both the state and federal level as politicians started to kind of wake up to the crisis and try to address it. At the state level, we found that as state medical boards and state lawmakers were trying to tamp down on prescribing or create some new guidelines, that kind of thing. There were lobbyists from opioid companies ready to step in. In some cases, they even hired a PR firm to work with a medical board, that kind of thing, and present what they called the other side of the story, that there are, you know, these chronic pain patients out here who don't want to be treated like criminals, and therefore, you know, we should really kind of weaken some of these measures. Mm. That went on in a number of different states. Over that time period that we've been looked at over 10 years, the drug makers and their allies in this particular group that we looked at spent $880 million on lobbying and political contributions. So they had this huge arsenal that went to some other topics as well, but a lot of that was focused on opioid prescribing issues. And they were able to accomplish a lot at the state and federal level. At the state level, they also had nonprofit allies that you wouldn't really expect, but groups like the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network gets a lot of money from drug makers, and they, you know, towed the drug maker line on opioids in many states as these bills came up for debate. We also found that at the federal level, you know, they were really able to create this echo chamber in terms of what was being discussed about this issue before people began to realize, you know, how bad it really was. So, Rose, you actually included one of the figures that has gotten to be really popular for people to cite, 100 million Americans in chronic pain. Well, we looked at, it turns out that 100 million Americans is, that number includes people who have, you know, a little bit of, you know, pain in their toe or like a small migraine every day or whatever, that are just managing it just fine, that don't necessarily need opioids or maybe aren't even any medication for it. The pain lobby was able to not only lobby for the report to get created that came up with that figure and have people who were aligned with it, who worked for organizations receiving grants from them to on the committee that produced the report, but then once it came out, they very effectively shopped that figure around to the head of the FDA, to senators, to everyone, to say, like, look how bad this pain problem is. We have to address that. And as we address, you know, the opioid issue, we have to, at the same time, keep these 100 million Americans in mind. And actually, just the other week, the National Academy of Science and Engineering and Medicine came out and said, you know, actually, that 100 million figure, we're not going to really stand by that anymore. We can't find good evidence for that. So they did not include that in their most recent report. And I think that was a good indication that they had been reading some of the journalism that's out there, like our story now, saying that these drug makers were very influential in the political arena on this issue.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because I got that number from the commission that was set up by Donald Trump to look at this opioid crisis. It's being led by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. And in the report, they talk about 100 million people who suffer from chronic pain. And I guess I didn't bat an eyelash, because I have people very close to me who suffer with chronic pain. So I just thought, yeah, that sounds maybe about right. But it's interesting you say that. I mean, I'm just searching it now. Vox, Atlantic, Christian Science Monitor, they all have that 100 million number in their stories.
Yeah. And the, you know, the pain, the group of companies that we talked about in our stories, the Pain Care Forum, they specifically lobbied on the bill that asked for the study to show people the number of people in pain. They got that passed in around 2008, and ever since then, that has been the talking point. And it's an easy one to fall back on. It's ubiquitous, but it, like I said, now the original kind of author, the group that authored that study, has gone back and said, actually, you know, we don't really have a foundation for that. And there were a number of people who, you know, who've gotten grants from pharmaceutical companies, that kind of thing, involved in the creation of that original report. So,
Well, this is why it's always so important to follow the money, which Liz Essley White does as a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. She teamed up with the AP last year looking at drug makers' influence on the response to the opioid crisis. And you can find all of her stories at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Sam Quinones, independent journalist and author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. According to the CDC, 142 Americans die of a drug overdose every day, and two-thirds of those deaths are linked to opioids. Now we have cities, counties, and states suing pharmaceutical companies like Purdue, which makes OxyContin, saying that they caused the crisis with a campaign of fraud and deception. We did reach out to Purdue. They said they couldn't make the time work. We also invited Pharma, the big lobbyist for Big Pharma, and they say they cannot comment on legal actions regarding specific companies. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question you feel that needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about a series of intercept reports about surveillance at Standing Rock. A number of documents expose the inner workings of what's being called a surveillance industrial complex. That's tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. Today, we are talking about the opioid crisis in the United States. The numbers are just shocking. 142 Americans die of a drug overdose every single day, and two-thirds of those deaths are linked to opioids. Now we are seeing a number of states, cities, and counties suing pharmaceutical companies, saying that they caused this crisis with a campaign of fraud and deception. What do you think? Should drug companies be held responsible? And if so, how? A number of these lawsuits are calling for, in some cases, tens of millions of dollars to pay for treatment and also to help families who have lost loved ones. If you have a personal story to share on this, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Today we're joined by Liz Esley White, a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, and Sam Quinones, independent journalist and author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. And before we get to calls, Sam, I wanted to get your take on the approach that government officials are now taking. They're suing these companies saying they caused this crisis. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it seems to me that yes, that this is exactly what they're doing, and that it seems to me, and one way of thinking about what they're doing is that they are trying to kind of right price these drugs. These drugs, the price that people pay, do not actually reflect the true cost of these drugs, and the true cost is quite a bit broader, to jails, to courts, to emergency rooms, to public health departments, et cetera. You could go on quite a long way. They've been only moderately successful. A couple of states, I think Kentucky, West Virginia, have had some success with these. Others have not. They've had to postpone or had their cases thrown out. I think the case in Everett, Washington, mm-hmm. is a very interesting one to watch, because they are using a different legal theory than has been used in the past, which was, in the past, they kind of used the theory that was along the lines of what they used with the tobacco industry and individual smokers, harm done to individual smokers. Well, the argument is that these pills are actually legitimate medicine, and in fact, that is the case. They are very, very, very effective drugs when used in certain ways. And so the drug manufacturers, I think, in some cases have been able to argue, look, we are producing something that has a benefit, and doctors were prescribing it the way it was accepted in medicine at the time, and so therefore we're not culpable. The Everett case is one of the more interesting, I think, because they've used a different legal theory, and that is to say that Purdue in particular knew, had records of which doctors and pharmacists in the Everett, Washington region were prescribing and filling prescriptions in an egregious way, in a irresponsible way, and that the company did nothing to let people know that this was happening, and therefore they are culpable. And there's millions, of course. The thing is this: this has been what's fascinating to me about this is that this has been a story in which all the profits really have been privatized. All the profits have gone to drug companies, really, by and large. Purdue is owned by the Sackler family. The Sackler family is now one of the wealthiest families in America, due almost entirely to the billions of dollars of sales of OxyContin since 1996. All the costs have been borne, or most of the costs, I would say, have been borne by the public, by jails, again, public health departments, courts, on and on and on. You could go on quite a bit. And so these suits are an attempt, seems to me, of balancing that or rectifying that to some degree.
And OxyContin has made Purdue $31 billion since it hit the market back in 1996. Sam, we did a show yesterday about the Department of Justice's and the government's failure to go after top-level executives. And I just wonder what you think about that, because we just learned that Purdue had to pay $600 million and three executives paid $34 million in fines for making statements that were, quote, inconsistent. And Dr. Kolodny said that they paid the fines, but really nothing changed. And that seems to be a trend with corporations across the board.
One problem is, I think that one of the most important thing that Andrew was saying was that there is that what grew out of all this, I think, is a new culture of using these pills. I think that is the biggest problem we face today, honestly, is that there is now just a reliance on these pills for all manner of pain. And the problem is that pain is extraordinarily difficult to deal with. It's a mysterious thing in each individual, what causes pain and how you deal with it in each individual, given that individual's background and history and so on, is very, very difficult. So doctors over the last 20 years, I would say, due to med schools adopting this philosophy, et cetera, it's grown to be part of our culture. And I think in some ways it's actually been a crutch for a lot of doctors. For a lot of doctors, it was viewed as a boon, like this is this great welcome thing. You're now able to deal with pain patients, who take up so much of your time in the waiting in your clinics. And now here, all you have to do now is write them a prescription for this, and they're on their way, and they're happy, and this takes care of it all. And doctors were like, hallelujah, this is fantastic, because it's very difficult to deal with this. The biggest problem now, I think, really, is eradicating a culture that is widespread from coast to coast of prescribing these pills. So that to me is where we stand right now, and to me it's the biggest challenge that we face.
And I was reading at a website about addiction, about how these pills actually work, and they describe it as the following: opioids act as a central nervous system depressant, slowing down nerve signal transmissions and blocking pain sensations from reaching the brain. While opioids pose little potential for harm when they're taken as prescribed, the abuse of the drug sets off a series of damage effects inside the brain. Chemical workings. So if you're told that OxyContin is going to last for 12 hours and it only lasts for 8, you're going to want more because the tolerance levels rise. And then is that right?
No, I think that's true. The other problem that we face, though, is this, and that is that across the country, as Andrew was saying earlier, there was this idea that these pills are now known to be virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain.
Did we just lose Sam? Sam, are you there? Oh, all right. We'll reconnect with him. Sorry about that. Liz, do you want to jump in there and talk about that? The other thing that I've been reading is that if people can no longer afford an opioid, or if the doctor refuses to prescribe it, at that point, they turn to heroin.
Yeah, a lot of heroin users start with prescription opioids. You hear a lot of stories about, you know, teenagers who overdose on heroin who started with, you know, a broken ankle in high school or whatever, and got a bottle of Percocet. And, you know, another thing that has changed since the 2007 Purdue lawsuit, which, you know, we haven't talked about yet, is that Purdue and a lot of the other drug companies kind of shift tactics. They said, you know, actually we are seeing this epidemic and it seems like people are worried about addiction. So they came up with what are known as abuse deterrent formulations. A lot of addicts on painkillers would, instead of just you know, swallowing them as doctor ordered, they'd crush them up and snort them or inject them, you know, after they crush them or do different things to kind of make the high come at, all at once. And so Purdue and other drug companies looked at ways they can make the pill not do that. So Purdue and there's certain types, there's different types, but one of them is, you know, you can't crush it. Another is, you know, once you, if you do crush it, then the opioid part that gives you the high is counteracted by an antagonist. Anyway, and these drugs, you know, why they sound great, there's a number of different things that, you know, are caveats with them. Number one, they're way more lucrative. They're making the drug companies tons more money because they don't have generic competitors yet. They're still patented. Second, you know, they're giving some doctors the illusion that these are in themselves good drugs that cannot be addictive whatsoever, which is not true. You can still swallow these pills whole and get high off of them. Third, because they are more expensive, when these kinds of drugs became more popular and on the market, a lot of people did turn to heroin. And so now we're seeing the medical community take a second look at them and say, wow, these, you know, really are aspirational in terms of actually helping anybody. But in the last 5 years, we've seen pharmaceutical lobbyists go out and tout abuse deterrent formulations as a way to, you know, a tool in the toolbox to really help fight the opioid crisis. When health experts are saying, you know, hold on, we don't know that they're actually that great. But meanwhile, state legislatures have passed, you know, and considered 100 bills that would basically make doctors more likely to prescribe this type of more lucrative painkiller.
What are your thoughts, Liz, on these lawsuits that have been filed against these companies? Again, we did invite Purdue and Pharma, the lobby group for these pharmaceutical companies, but they declined our requests.
Yeah, it is very hard to prove that, you know, in some cases these municipalities, et cetera, are suing drug distributors, and it's hard to say, you know, that a drug distributor who is, you know, selling something that was approved by the FDA and in a lot of cases was, if someone did have an overdose, was misused by the patient, that it's their fault. So they have a kind of long uphill climb, I think, in order to be successful. It's possible that we may see a lot of different settlements come out of it. You know, just keep the litigation going long enough that drug companies decide it's best to just get this over with and pay a hefty settlement. But yeah, historically it's been tough to say that, you know, it is drug makers' fault specifically for overdoses or that kind of thing. I think like Sam was saying, the one in Everett may be a little bit more interesting in terms of the city's pretty upfront about saying, you know, you need to pay for all the social workers and police costs and that kind of thing that we've had to deal with because you weren't telling us where the problem doctors were.
Yeah, right. And the New York Times quoted James Tierney in a piece about this, a former Maine attorney general who advised states during the tobacco litigation. And he said that the big difference is that opioids are highly regulated products whose use can be tracked and which, when used properly, offer important benefits to patients. He says, by comparison, tobacco was regulated lightly and in the normal course of its use causes illness and death, facts that the industry long denied. But then they quoted another Mississippi Attorney General, Michael Moore, who said, I definitely think these lawsuits have potential. I may get back involved. So each story has the person who says this might not work and then another person who says these lawsuits might work.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of these attorneys general are shopping out these cases to, you know, private lawyers that they hire who are experts at suing these companies, too. So we'll see how they go. remains to be seen.
Liz Esley-White is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity who conducted a 10-month investigation about drug makers' influence on the response to the opioid crisis, massive lobbying at the state and federal levels. And Sam Quinones is back with us, an independent journalist and author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. And let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. Sam and Liz and yourself are doing a tremendous public service on this. I took oxycodone after a maxofacial problem, a blocked salivary gland. And a neighbor who had a long history of substance abuse said, you know, and he said this out of love. He said, you take that for a couple of days and you have a new friend, meaning a monkey. I didn't have that problem. But in New York, where I just visited, in their subways, they have ads for people who are friends and family of people who are addicted, you know, to have the blocking medication, like a Narcan or something like that. And that's all over the subways in New York. You know, this is on top of the meth epidemic too. You know, when Sam says this is the largest epidemic in this country's history, after the Civil War, people were, you know, the soldiers were addicted, and we've had so much other stuff. We had, I mean, Eric Holder went back to his Wall Street office, and Mitch McConnell is from Kentucky. These are people who are benefiting. I'm glad that they're going to go after. I'm glad that these cities and states are going after the on civil grounds. These drug companies, you know, if anything else ever caused that many deaths in this country, you know, we'd be talking, you know, line them up. You know, this has got, and a lot of these people may be people who, you know, you want to talk about forgotten people in this country, you know, whether it was the crack epidemic or this one.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's so true, Bill. Thank you. A couple of the doctors quoted in various articles, and I should say social workers, are just talking about how desperate people are. No, they cannot find jobs, especially in the Rust Belt, cannot make ends meet. And that leads to, you know, drug overdoses, sadly. So it's not just pain we're talking about. It's also these social problems and inequality. And I hope you can listen to yesterday's show, Bill, because we discussed a lot of the issues that you just raised about the government going after corporations or not going after corporations and just the way that that's changed over the years. So thank you for calling and thank you for sharing your story. Let's go next to Don in Benicia. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I'm just curious. I totally agree that these pharmaceutical companies should be held responsible, but I'm wondering why doctors aren't ultimately held responsible. They're the point of care. These are the people that are prescribing these medications to patients. Now, I'm a nurse, and I see this happen a lot where patients come in with conditions that do not warrant opioids, but they demand to have these medications prescribed to them, and doctors ultimately, most of the time, give it to them. I don't see other methods being employed. We are not focused on that. And
Thank you for calling, and sorry your line just went bad there. The PBS NewsHour had a piece in October, and they interviewed David Armstrong, a journalist with the health news site Stat, and he was just talking about how, for example, the company Abbott Labs, which has been sued over 1,000 times collectively for problems related to OxyContin, they're a partner in marketing with Purdue, and he said that there's this thing called the Dine and Dash program, and Abbott reps would meet a doctor at a restaurant, pay for his takeout order, and then while he's waiting to pay for the order, sell him on the benefits of OxyContin. I mean, Sam, he had so many examples about how these reps have very close relationships with doctors.
Yes, that's true. That was happening years ago. My impression is, frankly, it's not happening so much anymore. I think, first of all, doctors are far less willing to listen to that kind of stuff. Honestly, I think they've been burned. They feel burned a little bit on this. But the other thing is this: a big part of how this happened had to do with a pharmaceutical sales force arms race, is what I call it, basically. That began in the early 90s. And in the early 90s, we had roughly 30,000 sales reps across the country. For pharmaceutical companies. And by 2003, we had 120,000. Now, those numbers have dropped off considerably. But a big part of this was that there was so many of these sales reps bombarding clinics, and not just to sell opiates. They were selling all kinds of drugs. But Purdue was one main participant in this. And so you're getting, I think it's another era now. People are not getting that kind of bombarding, the bonuses that Purdue was paying were the highest ever in the history of the industry by quite a bit during those years. Particularly the crucial years in all this were 96 to the early 2000s, 2003, 4, right in there. When you got the formation, as I said earlier, the culture of prescribing that has really kind of gripped medicine ever since.
Well, thank you for calling in, Don. We had a couple other questions about doctors, so thanks for addressing that one, Sam. And we have just a couple minutes left. Sam, where do you see this going in terms of these government officials across the country trying to hold drug makers responsible for this? Senator Claire McCaskill is also demanding corporate documents from 5 companies. She wants to know how they market their drugs.
Well, I suspect this will continue. This has hit very intensely a lot of small counties around the country, rural counties, suburban counties, and they do not, very notoriously, have a lot of budget. And so they are. I think it makes a lot of sense, and it also makes sense from a political standpoint to show as a politician that you are now doing something about this. I'd be very interested to see how these suits work out. I would not have a clue how that's going to happen,
right?
Whether they'll win or not. But also, part of the problem is too that these are not the largest drug manufacturers in America. Purdue is not very big. It's made a lot of money, but it doesn't compare, say, to Pfizer or Merck, one of these big, huge ones. They do not have all the deep pockets that I think a lot of people believe they have. And so it'll be very interesting. I certainly believe it's going to continue because so many counties are just desperate to find some way of paying for this unending cost associated with this epidemic.
Senator McCaskill is looking at Purdue, Janssen Pharmaceuticals, Insys, Depomed, and Mylan. And
right.
Liz, what about you? Where do you think this is going?
Yeah, well, I think as the federal government continues to find ways to, fight the opioid epidemic, a lot of states and counties will try to follow suit. The CDC last year released its guidelines for doctors, and those have had a profound impact on how state lawmakers, for example, look at the issue. Trying to create state legislation based on that encourages doctors not to prescribe opioids for common ailments. You're seeing things like the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, going back to doctors, mandate patient satisfaction surveys that included questions about, how was your pain treated, and doctors sometimes felt pressure that they would get a bad score on those surveys if they didn't hand out, opioids. So that's changing soon. There are a number of different measures that will hopefully, and these little ways that have been ingrained in the system, make it so that opioid prescribing isn't through the roof like we've seen now that people are aware of the problem. And as drug companies look to address their reputations as well, I think that we'll see, hopefully, changes happen.
And it's not just the drug companies, it's also drug distributors. The New York Times had a story about McKesson Corporation. This is a San Francisco-based drug distributor, the nation's largest, and they're in the center of this crisis. Their CEO, John Hammergren, currently makes $692 million at that company. And earlier this year, McKesson agreed to pay $150 million for failing to report suspiciously large orders of drugs. So, Liz, it's the whole system. It's not just the drug companies.
Yeah, and it's ways in which, you know, it's been embedded in state laws and medical board guidelines, things like that over the years, and ways that drug companies and drug distributors have influenced that process. I mean, throughout the 90s, you had people passing things called intractable pain acts, which said, you know, you have a right to have your pain treated by these drugs in state law. And now states are kind of waking up and repealing those. And, I think we'll see more and more of that.
Do you think that contributions to politicians from Big Pharma will continue?
They are the one of the largest, if not, I think in the states, they are the largest lobbying force of pharmaceutical companies at large. They just swamp every other interest group in terms of state lobbying. That will continue.
At a time when there's a lot of pressure on politicians to do something, who's getting the biggest contributions?
You see a lot of chairs of health committees in state legislatures, and, you know, politicians all over the board in Congress and elsewhere getting huge contributions. And a lot of times, you know, as we've chronicled, if you look at the kind of bills they're sponsoring, they get contributions at the time they're sponsoring those bills. For example, the legislation that created that 100 million pain figure that we talked about, people in pain, the lawmakers who sponsored those bills were from both sides of the aisle in Congress, and they both got hefty contribution checks for their campaigns from pharmaceutical makers.
And Sam, final thoughts from you?
I think, well, what we really have not talked about now and is extraordinarily important is the fact that all this heroin is now coming in, fentanyl are now coming into our country in unprecedented amounts as well, from Mexico primarily, fentanyl drugs, chemicals maybe originating in China, but I think they're coming mostly up through Mexico. That's what this has created, in fact. It is that you have a whole new population of opiate addicts, and now they are looking for alternatives that are not as expensive as these pills when they get desperate enough, their addictions get high enough. And they are turning to heroin and fentanyl. Fentanyl is an extraordinarily scary thing. That is one of the most dangerous, scary things I've seen come along in drugs in many, many, many years. The effects of that on counties, on towns that are filing these lawsuits, I think fentanyl has in fact been one of the main reasons why a lot of these counties are moving ahead with this, because the effect on budgets and on just the nature of community in those towns and those areas has just been destroyed because of this. And fentanyl is the next kind of we had opiate pill prescribing and pill overdosing and addiction and so on. Then people moved to heroin. The latest step in all this is fentanyl, and it's very, very scary.
Well, we'll continue to follow that. Sam Quinones is an independent journalist and author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Liz Esley White is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Liz and Sam, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.